Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we will be discussing to what extent technology should dictate your newsroom strategy. This was a big theme at our last Newswired conference, where we heard no shortage of talks on how technology was changing the playing field in search, social, cookies, and of course, the hot topic right now, generative AI. And naturally, newsrooms must adapt to these changes. But does this mean we can lose sight of our audiences? Is there a best of both worlds where the tech can in fact help us serve our newsroom mission and purpose? Here to chew over that with us is our keynote speaker, Sean Gowley, an AI whiz with a background in starting and selling tech companies and a current tech startup investor. It's a wake-up call that newsrooms are increasingly out of their depth as the pace of this technology is rapidly evolving at an unprecedented rate of knots. But not all is doom and gloom. There is a hopeful world where the technology can be used for good. Stay tuned to find out more.
So within 7 years, 8 years, we've gone from the first pictures, the first scientific papers being published into kind of products that you can download today that can generate minutes of full motion video.
That's Sean Gowley. He founded the data visualization company Quid and sold that in 2015. He then founded the Silicon Valley-based AI company Primer and sold that a year ago. He is now an investor in deep technology startups. He's talking here about how sophisticated artificial intelligence is becoming, even at this relatively nascent stage where generative AI is only really about 7 years old at this point.
So when you look at the first generative AI type of technology called a GAN or a generative adversarial network, where the first pictures are being generated by machine, right? They're very pixelated. They're about 256 pixels by 256 pixels. And you've gone from that to today we're seeing open source models being released by different organizations around the world that are capable of generating high definition, full frame rate video. And I don't think it's beyond the scope of anyone's sort of projection on this to join another couple of dots together and think about full motion videos winning Oscars in the coming years, generated by machines, or at least predominantly generated by machines. That's on the image side. On the language side, it trails the images generally by a couple of years, but you've gone from computers being able to kind of generate a couple of sentences in 2015, not very good grammatically, now into being able to entertain kind of, by all accounts, a passing grade on any kind of substantive measure of a Turing test.
The big challenge that throws up for news organizations is just how rapidly the technology is changing and improving.
The speed of this is amazing, but also the recency. And I would say we're very much in the early innings of artificial intelligence, of where it has come from. You know, the speed at which it's hit us, I think, is unprecedented. Like, it makes the adoption of mobile phones and the internet look very, very slow. And I don't think we're approaching the ceiling of these technologies, at least not yet, right? Like, it seems as though there's going to be at least two or three more years of this rapid growth. We're fast moving into a space where a lot of cognitive human tasks are adequately performed by machines and soon to be machines performing them at superhuman or at least virtuoso human levels.
So a very scary prospect that the future could make it so that generative AI is as good as a virtuoso, to use Sean's phrase. But why is it moving so fast? What's different about this tech? And is the sky really the limit here?
You know, at the start, they look like they're going nowhere. In the middle, they look very, very steep. And towards the end, they look like S-curves.
And are we in that middle section now?
I would say we are very much on the steep upward slope. The S-curve, you know, will obviously come. I don't think we're immune of the lessons from history. Like, S-curves do tend to emerge. But it doesn't seem like that's coming now. And I think the reason why I'd be confident in that is speaking with the engineering groups that are leading these efforts and the people working on this, is there are so many kind of easy wins, right? There are so many easy wins from an engineering perspective. We just change this, we just do that, if we modify this, so we never really looked over here. And each of those changes yields an impressive performance boost. And so when you're seeing that many changes that are that easy to find by the different engineering groups, it suggests that we're nowhere near the surface of it or the ceiling of it. What I will say, though, is the cost of running these things may be the ultimate ceiling, right? Like, we've not really embarked as a species on these you know, very many of these $100 billion plus mega projects, right? And that side of it, I do think is perhaps, if you were to draw a ceiling, you know, is perhaps where that ceiling might come from. It's just our, you know, willingness to kind of throw capital at these mega projects.
Well, one could argue there are people with deep enough pockets that may want to invest in this technology such that it does develop that rapidly.
Yeah, that's true. Look, you know, I spent, you know, 6 years on the board of one of the largest energy companies in the world, and we certainly knew a thing or two about large CapEx projects, right? But once you get up into tens of billions of dollars being spent, there's actually a very, very finite number of groups that can actually fund that. So you're talking a smaller and smaller cohort. Count them on a single hand, the kinds of groups that might want to fund this. And the markets have so far proven a very good source of capital. But, you know, even public markets have a ceiling of how much money they're willing to kind of bet on what's, you know, still relatively risky technological endeavors at a massive CapEx scale.
On the visual side, there are quite innocuous examples of applications for generative AI, like politicians playing Minecraft. But generally, people are literate enough to realize that those videos are fake. But on the more dangerous side, generative AI is more than capable of producing convincing fabrications of reality, not just by the rich and powerful, but ordinary internet users.
One of the examples I saw on Twitter, someone had posted, or X, had posted an image of a flood with a girl and a little puppy, you know, from the Asheville floods in America earlier this year. And, you know, it was pretty convincing, pretty realistic. I think if you know a little bit about the kind of the characteristics of how these models perform, you could probably guess that it might be fake. And when this was flagged on community notes, they said, look, this is fake. And the person who posted this said, look, you know, I don't care, right? This, for me, this image captures how I'm feeling. It captures the empathy. It captures the things. And it was effectively this kind of, you know, sort of little vignette of, you know, the fact checker's coming along and saying, well, no, this is wrong. This didn't happen. And the person saying, I don't care that it didn't happen. I acknowledge that it didn't happen, but I prefer the reality where it did, right? I prefer living in the simulation, as it were. I prefer to have the world conformed to a view that doesn't challenge any of my beliefs. And I think this is sort of the interesting thing, right? Like, we know that if we challenge people on any kind of information that is distorting or that didn't happen or isn't real, then people will embrace that. This is a sort of an implicit assumption. But I think the interesting thing is that people may reject it, right? They may reject this stuff. And you know, far from choosing the red pill and the matrix, they continue to sit and enjoy the relatively comfortable, if not sort of benign existence of being a brain in a vat.
It's not all doom and gloom, though. Sean has an optimistic view for the news industry, where it can build a generative AI based on the right values, data, and truth.
Can build these models to have much more of a grounding in truth. And then if you think about that, you say, well, I can have a model that can generate a story for every single reader based on what they've read before, based on where their interests are, based on how much they know about the topic. And in a way, you can have your own personal briefing like the president of the United States would have from the intelligence organizations. You can have that delivered to you by an automated team of AI agents that are writing for you. But you can also go back and ask questions of it and say, well, you said this. Why did you say this and not that? You know, have you got any critiques on this point that you've made? It seems somewhat, you know, controversial according to my perspective. Can you convince me? And so this kind of dynamic, I think, is really, really fascinating, right? Like, what does an AI agent that works for you to generate you a briefing of the world that's grounded in truth, that's questionable, that's answerable, that updates according to your knowledge as it changes? And indeed, there was a fascinating study that was done a month ago where they took a whole bunch of people that had conspiracy beliefs, right? Everything from man didn't land on the moon through to, you know, JFK was assassinated by a government, you know, a government.
Inside job, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Conspiracy, right? And they put them in front of a large language model, right? You know, today's generation of large language models that had been specifically tasked to remain truthful, to be polite, to be understanding, but to ultimately dissuade these people of their conspiracy theories. And what was fascinating on that is it was actually very successful, right? In a relatively short amount of time, about 10 minutes of conversation, the language model had created across the population a 20% reduction in conspiracy beliefs. And 3 months later, that result was maintained and was held. And so you look at this here and you say, well, normally the kind of the orthodoxy is don't engage with a conspiracy theorist because they'll just dig into their beliefs, right? And it's almost like there's sort of nothing you can do to change their mind. But this technology came along and said, actually, you know, these AI systems are actually very persuasive, right? And, you know, of course, that has positives and negatives. You persuade them to believe something, you can persuade them to believe something else, and sort of this kind of, you know, dynamic is certainly exists. But it's fascinating, right, that we start to get to a place where these models are better than us as humans at things like empathy, are better than us at writing, at better than us at drawing, at creating, at changing and persuading people's minds and debating and arguing. It's perhaps not surprising that these results are popping up, but it's also one of those things and you say, well, this technology, you know, it can do, of course, many, many things. But I think the news organizations and journalists have to lean into the fact of becoming students of the technology and start thinking about how they want to deploy it in aid of the mission that they're on.
So that's a very hopeful idea that there are positive applications for generative AI in news. We heard plenty of examples of those at NewsWired, from translating content to grow reach and audience to leveraging new developments in AI-powered search engines. But to what extent are these services that support society and strengthen democracy? That was a big critique we heard from Mattia Peretti, the former manager of the Journalism AI Initiative, now the founder of News Alchemists, a movement of media innovators. He said that news organizations must not lose sight of their mission and purpose as they look to innovate.
We need to think about user-centric, sustainable solutions for the future of journalism. And in this article, I was going as far as saying that we're getting this AI thing all wrong. Of course, I was being a little provocative, mostly wrong. There are good examples out there. But I really feel, especially with the generative AI boom, we have been experimenting with a lot of different things, and yet the audience is largely missing from the conversation. Honestly, with the exception maybe of the last panel, I would go into saying that we haven't really talked much about the people we're supposed to serve in this room so far today. And that, I think, it's part of the problem that we need to consider. And this is what I think the way we're approaching AI, right? We think, let me just take a little bit of AI, sprinkle a little bit on top of what we do to make it better, make it more salty, but without actually considering that there is a fundamental problem in what we do in the first place.
So if Sean thinks this is indeed possible, what are the realistic first steps forward for the news industry? Three immediate steps: solve the errors like hallucinations, provide access to good data, and train users to change behavior and adopt the technology.
Look, engineering challenges, there's obviously a huge amount of money and compute that needs to go into this. There's data challenges. And then, of course, you know, there's the end user that needs to be skilled with engaging on the stuff as well. So I think that stuff is optimistic. I think that the bit on this is, you know, it requires a very different type of skill set from the one that most journalists have. But, you know, it's been interesting. If you look at like Stephen Berlin Johnson, who went and joined Google and has been working with them on the Notebook LM system, you know, as a sort of a journalist writer, has been working there. And it's been really interesting, kind of the collaborations that they've had and they've made. I think one of the most interesting you know, releases has been this Notebook LM, where you can upload a scientific paper, you can upload, you know, an economist article, you can upload your master's thesis, and it will create a podcast, you know, with two hosts that will sit down, much like we're doing now, and discuss whatever document you gave it, right? You know, we talked earlier at the start of this conversation about how fast this technology is improving, right? And so, you know, it's going to be crazy to think where this technology goes in 12 months' time. But I would imagine, you know, things like this, where you get the sense of like, I have an AI that's working for me. I know the data I've given it. I know it's been trained by people that are familiar with journalism practices, and the team of the product makers are on it, have got a sense of what good writing looks like. I have a trust in the system. And, you know, I'm consuming scientific research in a way that I wouldn't otherwise have engaged with. And, you know, I think stuff like that, as you start painting these pictures, it comes down to the sense of, well, what products are we designing? Who owns the products? Who's designing those products? Whose interests do they have at heart? What is the economic deal that we're making here? So I think all of that is perhaps not specific to AI. This is just general kind of sort of economic theory. But I've no doubt you can make this. Do I think that's where we'll end up? No, I think, you know, the technology probably bends towards creating realities that are more comforting to people and not really challenging. And I think we probably bend towards slightly more dystopic, you know, future.
So before we get too carried away, it's more likely that people misuse the technology than try to use it for good. A utopian reality for generative AI is not as likely as the dystopian. So in that sense, news is outgunned in this space. But what else is new, eh? Of course, one of those steps Sean's mentioned is a contentious one, access to data. It was a sore point as we heard how news content has been forced onto generative AI databases against its will. So really the question is, how should news respond? Two schools of thought were argued in a session about how to deal with Gen AI companies. Try to work with them, a la Axel Springer, to remain relevant on the internet and monetize what you can, which is the argument put forward by SEO futurist and media consultant Jess Schultz, one of her clients being Rynier Media. The alternative is to take on AI companies via lawsuits, just like Justine Roberts, founder of Mumsnet. She thinks publishers must get big tech to pay for content, and until they do, legal action is the best bet, as we can't wait for or rely on government intervention. However, in our closing keynote, former CNN anchor Nina Dos Santos picked up on the definite skepticism in the room about working with AI companies.
Many of you in the audience over the coffee breaks and lunch breaks have been talking to me about how you felt when you were listening to that impassioned debate between the Mumsnet founder Justine Roberts and Jess Schultz about whether or not to embrace AI or not. And I'd just like to ask, could I have a show of hands in the room about those who agreed with Justine Roberts? And those who agreed with Jess? Nobody. There you go. And I think that says a lot for our industry when it comes to the sort of skepticism that we are currently experiencing at the moment with regards to AI.
And just for the absence of doubt there, lots of people sided with Justine's pro-Sue stance, and nobody lifted their hand in support of Jess's position. But here's a good chance to get the perspective of someone without a dog in the fight. What's Sean's take on how the news industry should proceed with AI companies? His somewhat surprising response is that AI companies need news content a lot more than they are letting on, and maybe more than they even realize themselves.
These models, if you don't continually feed them new information about the world, like journalism, they get stuck and frozen in time, right? So the model would have no knowledge of COVID, the model will have no knowledge of the latest election. The model would have no knowledge of if we've discovered life on Mars, right? Like the model without news is frozen in time and it loses a lot of its value, right? The model, if it's current and it knows about everything that's going on in the world, these large language models are a lot more valuable. And so the news provides, and the journalists that create that news provide a huge resource. Not just in training the models to kind of quote unquote be smart, but to actually train them to understand what's happening in the world. So there does seem to be a symbiotic relationship. And so if I'm looking at this here in a longer vision, I think these models to be smart need to have a relationship with journalists because they need journalists to kind of power the ground truth that these models are based on. So there does seem to be a symbiotic relationship, which means there should be a financial relationship. And if that isn't negotiated by the individual journalism organizations, it should be negotiated by the governments to allow for this relationship to occur. The same token, the journalists can do better work as these models get smarter and they actually report better journalism, but it also removes this kind of sense of like the journalism that's valuable to these models is not 10 things you didn't know about Harry Styles' latest fashion ensemble. The journalism that's valuable is, wow, I've got the story and no one else has written about it. And this story is net additive to the knowledge that these models in the world that we live in has. And so I think there is a pathway through this, but the money that is being paid to these models, some of that has to come back and support the news ecosystem that grounds these models. So this relationship, economically, it should make sense. I don't think that's what will happen. I think probably government needs to step in and say, look, there's some public benefit of journalism. And also, like, it's not going to be too bitter a pill to swallow for some sort of levy on the taxes made from these models that goes back to the journalism that ultimately supports it. And, you know, I think there is a win-win here. But it's not going to happen, you know, with these companies chasing Q1 2025 earnings targets. It's going to happen, I think, with considerable arm bending from some of the governments around the world. And, you know, there's enough money to be made from these models that I don't think 5%, you know, extraction of that back to the news organizations that power these systems would be bad at all. And it's probably a significant step up than the fraction of a penny that you get from a Google click.
Now, hang on. I hear you say, we've heard all this before, right? That platforms need us as much as we need them, and we need to create a harmonious relationship. I know it's not that easy, especially if tensions between big tech platforms and the news industry are anything to go by in recent years. That's not one to hold our breath on. This is something that Chris Dicker, CEO of Candor Media, picked up on his Ask Me Anything session when asked whether there were lessons to learn from the past when working with big tech platforms. Here's Chris.
Is there something that we could learn from 20 years ago? To a degree, don't do a deal with the devil, right? And I think if we look at the media industry's acceptance of Google's behavior, and if everyone in this room knew how Google was going to behave, especially over the last few years, would we have allowed them to crawl our sites so thoroughly and stuff back then? Probably not. So is there anything we could learn going forward? I would say is be very, very careful in regards to who you do deals with. You've got to look at the value of the content you're producing. And if someone's not willing to part with the value that you're putting on your content, don't give it away. Just because someone thinks that, you know, that you may make some money in the future, don't give it away now for free just because of that.
The path forward, from Sean's perspective, leans a bit more on the side of government legislation and intervention, because he doesn't hold much hope for any sort of compromise.
But those are your three options. I think you try and broker a deal, but like there's not a lot of leverage, to be honest, because if it's sort of one of those things where it's like, well, all right, you're not going to get my data. And it's like, all right, cool. Well, I'll go to someone else who will give me your data. Or I've already got it, frankly. Like you've published it. I can stick a video camera in front of a screen and pretend to be a human browsing, pull all the text, and you know it's mine, right? So, like, I think it's a hard line to kind of go. I think collectively, you know, if there could be a group that could form together, like collectively, you may be able to kind of bargain. But the sort of the cooperate defect kind of dynamic of this just, I think, biases the defection. I think on the government side, I don't think that's out of the question, right? You know, you pointed to Australia. I sort of view that as a sort of a positive light, right? Which is to say, look, if you want to operate in this environment, here's the cost of doing business, right? Like you'll still be profitable. You're just going to pay effectively an overhead, a tax. And if you look at all major industries, whether it's energy, whether it's telecoms, whether it's, you know, increasingly, you know, the internet, once you get to these mega kind of infrastructure levels, you pay a license to operate, right? You have a set of externalities you need to account for. And, you know, the government comes in and says, yep, that's great. You can operate. Here's the system. And you're going to give us some money to do that. And that money is going to be used for A, B, and C. I think if I was running this, I would come to the table with a bit of leverage and would really want to invest into kind of saying, well, you know, if we can't find a deal, we're doing it ourselves. And so I do think, you know, investing into the talent to start to build some of these experiences for news organizations, you know, is ultimately not going to be a bad thing. And it's probably not as hard to do this, I think, as people think. I think it's the technologies and the open source communities are there. And there's a lot of people who want to sign up to a mission, you know, which is, you know, aligned with what journalists have been doing, you know, and so I think you would attract talent, and I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that, you know, one of the great AI agents would come out of a news organization.
And to be clear, we are starting to see more of those collective partnerships. OneEffra this year announced an AI accelerator deal with ChatGPT that would benefit 128 newsrooms around the world. And this speaks to the capacity and skill building Sean was speaking about a moment ago. Ideally, we need as an industry to get to a place where larger industry organisations can strike revenue deals for smaller publishers who do not have the same might as the likes of Axel Springer. But to wrap things up, Sean's parting message to news organisations is this: get journalists familiar with the tech, get your terms and conditions in check, recruit tech specialists to develop some new possibilities for your newsroom, and get serious about lobbying the government to take action.
There is so much that I think a strong, proficient user of these models can do from a research perspective, from a critiquing perspective, from an idea generation perspective. I think you can write better stories with these models. That doesn't mean you hit a button and the story is written for you. It means engage and use these models, and I think you can do better journalism. So that's number one, right? Like, do what you're doing, make use of the technology and do it better. Number two is get very precise on the legal usage of the data that you've got and the data that's around. Talk to other publishers. What have they done? Like, the legal kind of dynamics of this is really important, right? And I think becoming very familiar with how data, you know, is used in these models, could be used, might be used. I think you need to kind of arm yourself with an understanding of those models so that when you have the legal discussions, whether a deal is being done or not being done, you're having them in the right way, in the right place. I think number three is you need to hire some people. And I don't think it's a large number. I think it's a few people, or even, you know, group together in a consortium and partner with someone that isn't one of the major tech platforms, and start experimenting with what models might look like, right? What this technology might allow your users to do, right? So there's an experimentation phase, and you realize, I think, as you go through that, it's not as, you know, magical or opaque as perhaps, you know, the Valley would have you believe, but it's actually a relatively straightforward set of tools. And then the final piece here is, I think the media organizations within the countries need to get together and start to get serious about the lobbying on the government side of things. And I think, you know, where that is it does seem as though these tech companies will start to become subject to the same kinds of things the large energy telcos have had traditionally. And like, the sooner that can happen from a news perspective, I think the sooner the opportunity is for some of that to come back and support the public good that journalism is bringing to the societies that we all live in.
So the takeaway is that tech doesn't have to be a dirty word. We can't hope to get the best use cases out of generative AI if we wholesale boycott it. Make sure you are using it for the right reasons and in a way that genuinely serves the audience and your mission. But that doesn't mean doing a deal with the devil and giving away our valuable content for free. That's a lesson that we must learn from the past. These companies do need us, and they too can be frozen in time without a running supply of high quality, up-to-date and trusted news content. But what did you learn from today? Let's continue the conversation. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter /X at JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all of your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.